at the Chapel Theater, 4107 Southeast Harrison Street in Milwaukee, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, today. Reproducing the human race, valuing mothers and all caregivers. We hear from London-based author, strategist, women's rights and anti-racist campaigner, Selma James. And also from Professor Alison Wolfe, a peer in the House of Lords in the UK and author of The XX Factor, How Working Women Are Creating a New Society. They both opened a conference held in London, England, entitled Caring, Survival and Justice Versus the Tyranny of the Market. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. Students at an estimated 3,000 schools nationwide will walk out to protest gun violence. The student walkout at 10 a.m. will last 17 minutes, one for each victim of last month's massacre at Florida's Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Student organizer Cameron Kobe in Philadelphia said the official reaction to the massacre has been inadequate. She said the proposal to put guns into the hands of teachers makes her feel less safe at school.
In the situation with Nicholas Cruz, they said the only reason this occurred is because he was in a mentally unstable fit. But who's to say that my teacher could be going through a tough time in their lives and decide, or will finally reach their breaking point when a situation occurs in the classroom and decide to shoot?
Some students in Massachusetts say they plan to walk out and rally outside the Springfield headquarters of gunmaker Smith & Wesson. Democrat Connor Lamb is claiming victory in a squeaker of a special election, pitting him against Republican incumbent Rick Saccone.
Tonight, we celebrate regaining our voice and our vote in the great business of governing this country we love.
Unofficial results show Lamb's lead now stands at 641 votes out of more than 224,000 cast. Election officials say there are about 200 absentee votes and an unknown number of provisional ballots still to be counted. Saccone has not conceded. The district overwhelmingly voted for Donald Trump in 2016. Donald Trump's pick to be the next director of the CIA is a career official who oversaw torture at a secret prison during one of the darkest chapters in the agency's history. If confirmed, Deputy CIA Director Gina Haspel would become the first woman to lead the agency. Between 2003 and 2005, Haspel oversaw the agency's secret prison in Thailand, where Abu Zubaydah and Abd al-Rahim al-Nishri were waterboarded. Haspel also helped carry out an order to destroy waterboarding videos. Human rights advocates oppose Haspel's promotion. The group Human Rights First said no one who had a hand in torturing people deserves to lead an agency, and to allow such an appointment would be to willingly forget the nation's dark history with torture. Just hours after Donald Trump fired his Secretary of State via Twitter, Rex Tillerson addressed the media and pledged a smooth transition by his last day, March 31st.
To ensure an orderly and smooth transition during a time that the country continues to face significant policy and national security challenges. As such, effective at the end of the day, I'm delegating all responsibilities of the Office of the Secretary to Deputy Secretary of State Sullivan. My commission as Secretary of State will terminate at midnight, March the 31st.
Tillerson took no questions and did not mention Trump by name. Prime Minister Theresa May announced Britain will expel 23 Russian diplomats and break off high-level contacts with Russia over the nerve agent attack on a former spy and his daughter in an English town. May told lawmakers that the 23 diplomats who've been identified as undeclared intelligence officers have a week to leave.
And I continue to believe it is not in our national interest to break off all dialogue between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. But in the aftermath of this appalling act against our country, this relationship cannot be the same. So we will suspend all planned high-level bilateral contacts between the United Kingdom and the Russian Federation. This includes revoking the invitation to Foreign Minister Lavrov to pay a reciprocal visit to the UK.
May announced the measures after Russia failed to comply with a midnight deadline to explain how a nerve agent developed by the Soviet Union was used against Sergei and Yulia Skripal. Russia's ambassador in London said Britain's actions were absolutely unacceptable and a provocation. Russia has said it could not comply with Britain's demands unless the government provided samples of the poison collected by investigators. Theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking has died at his home in Cambridge, England. Hawking was the best-known theoretical physicist of his time, writing on the mysteries of space, time, and black holes. His book, A Brief History of Time, became an international bestseller, making him one of science's biggest celebrities since Albert Einstein. Hawking was diagnosed with ALS disease at the age of 21. He stunned doctors by living with the normally more quickly fatal illness for more than 50 years. Stephen Hawking died at the age of 76. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
In November of 2015, I attended a conference in London, England, entitled Caring, Survival, and Justice Versus the Tyranny of the Market. And I had the honor to chair the first panel, the opening panel of the conference, and the speakers were Selma James and Professor Allison Wolfe. Let us go to that conference and that sound I recorded right now. I'm delighted to introduce and welcome Selma James. She's the coordinator of the Global Women's Strike and founder of the International Wages for Housework campaign based at the Crossroads Women's Center. She is the author of Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning. She's the co-author of the internationally known classic, The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community. Now, that classic launched the domestic labor debate, as it is referred to, by spelling out how women produce and reproduce the entire workforce. Selma has years of experience in anti-racist organizing. She's quite an inspiring speaker, as you will experience. She is a contributor to The Guardian newspaper. And I'd also like to welcome Allison Wolfe. She is an economist and author, professor of public sector management at King's College London, and crossbench peer in the House of Lords. Her article, Working Girls, and her latest book, The XX Factor, How the Rise of Working Women Has Created a Far Less Equal World, highlight women's unequal incomes according to class. Allison has criticized the obsession with women in boardrooms. I'm sure she's been criticized for that as well. Is that true? She has criticized the obsession with women in boardrooms and Westminster, while the women and men workers on whom the golden skirts depend are low wage. So we're in for quite something, and let's give a warm welcome to Selma James.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to also welcome all of those who have come from other cities and other countries. We really have a lot to say to each other, and 2 days is hardly enough, but it's an important beginning, because I think we are beginning something in general at this moment in time, and in particular at this conference. The second thing I want to say is that I was married in this building. And I was quite astonished to be coming back 60 years later, something like that, to do something quite other than get married. So we start our conference at a moment in time when the world is changing, and changing fast and radically, positively and negatively, both. We in this country are aware that there has been an enormous shift in politics, in the sense that now the Labour Party is headed by people who are against austerity. Thank goodness for that. Thank goodness for that. On the other hand, we had the news last night and this morning. If we ever needed that kind of information, that caring is not the priority or the perspective of the society in which we live. And that has to do, I'm not referring only to those who killed and maimed. I'm referring to those who are far more guilty, who provided the impetus, who urged, who insisted that the society had to bomb Iraq and bomb Afghanistan and bomb wherever it felt like bombing, and didn't consider that the people who were being bombed were going to find at least some way of expressing their fury. But it does tell us that the conference that we're having is about the right thing. That is, what are we going to do? Are we going to prioritize the market and the oil and the arms industry and those that are undermining our environment, or are we going to concentrate, prioritize, make our perspective based on the human race? That's what we're here to discuss. And I do want to say that I particularly welcome Alison Wolfe's contribution, which we will sit and listen to not long from now. Because what Alison Wolfe has done has been to clarify an important part of what we have to defeat in order to build a caring society. And I hope that some of the things I say will tend to confirm that view. Now, we have been the carers, we women, and we know that now. And it's quite interesting that this issue of caring has now reached the academic agenda. They're always late, but they get there. And they're now discussing it, and they're studying us. And they haven't really a clue about what they're talking about. And that's pretty standard. When we say caring, what we mean are the basic relationships of society. And what has shielded us from seeing that sometimes is that women have been the providers of care almost exclusively, so that one doesn't see that it's a human quality and a human relationship, but that it has something to do with women. Now, we want to change that. Because one of the reasons that we want to change that is that it has reduced the view of women as some kind of minority. That's very serious. We're half the human race, at least half. the human race. But what we are concerned about, we as carers are concerned about, seems to be one issue among many others. It's not true. We are talking about the basic relationships of society. Now, I want to make a distinction before I go on between those of us who do caring, and that's almost all women, and an increasing number of men who are very interested in their own children. That's a big improvement. You know, between care and between the perspective of caring. And that is, we not only directly care for people, but we are concerned with life, protecting it and nurturing it wherever it presents itself and on an international level. And it is my view, and I think you might share it, that if the caring, the everyday, one-on-one caring that goes on in the society, if that is undermined and broken and discouraged and unfunded, the result is that the perspective of caring of the whole society is undermined, and I must say, unfunded, which is what we face right here in the UK. Now, in order to discuss it, I want to present a kind of potted history of the women's movement. Tell me when I have 5 minutes left.
Will do.
Otherwise, I can talk for an hour, you know, on this subject.
You're very good.
When the women's movement, the new women's movement, began in the late 60s and early 70s, all of the grievances of women were put out there. Rape, domestic violence, housework, and the fact that it wasn't shared. The fact that some of us were not allowed to go out to work because it wasn't ladylike. I mean, there were, you know, the way we were treated by doctors and hospitals. Every single aspect of our lives needed to be looked at again and confronted and remade. And it was the view of many or most of us that we wanted to change everything. Okay? We wanted to change the world. And some of us still think that. But many of us, as Alison will tell us more about, think that they want to integrate into a world that is rotten to the core. And we don't want that. Those of us who were socialists in the women's movement, some of us anyway, were looking for what is the specific relationship of women to capitalist society. You know, are we just somebody who should go out and get a job? As we were being told by many people, including on the left, maybe especially on the left, who wanted us to raise our consciousness to the level of men's. We lived through that. We lived through it. But many of us felt and began to discover that we were responsible for the reproduction of the labor force. We were indispensable. We were doing something important, and we had no power for doing it. Especially, we had no economic power. And some of us said, we'll go for wages for housework, and we will be able to confront at least the men in our families, or maybe they won't be in our families anymore once we have wages for housework, that we will have the basis of equity. And we will be able to demand that they share work. And we will be able to make our own sexual choices. And we will be able to go out to work with a modicum of power which will enable us to confront employers and say, we want the rate for the job. you know. So, but we were not successful. We were a few, and in many countries a few. But that was not the perspective that women thought they could win at that time, even if they believed they did. In the course of making the Wages for Housework campaign, the International Wages for Housework campaign, we discovered the world. You know, housework was not something that happened only in London, or even if we're broad-minded, in Edinburgh. It was something that was going on all over the world. Women were involved not only in taking care of people and feeding them, but growing the food that fed them. In other words, that women were working enormously long hours every day, doing all the work of reproduction that was being done in industrial countries, with no equipment, no money, no supermarket. They were doing this work, and we understood that our demand for money, for women, for the work that we were doing, was a massive international demand which had the whole world as a perspective. But we didn't win. What we won was some acknowledgement that work was going on. And as we worked on all kinds of issues that related to women's basic social and financial weakness, we began to really raise our sights. We were not discouraged because women in general had decided to go for the money by leaving their homes. In fact, we understood more broadly what we were doing. That is, it was not only we were making the workforce, we were making the whole human race. And that was not a side issue. And we refused to allow it to be reduced to that. Women went out to work and got very tired. By the way, we're going to talk about that in a moment. By the way, the women who stood for wages for housework in the U.S. and the U.K., and you know Fakhra will tell us about Norway and other countries, were the single mothers who fought for welfare, who said we are entitled to money for the work that we are doing, and we do not want a job outside the home. And one of the things we had to fight, you know, in establishing wages was that this work outside the home, what was it? What were we proposing? What was it proposed that we do that was going to... What was the job that was the dream job? Stacking shelves in supermarkets, working on assembly lines, at least in some parts of the world that's ended now, working in other factories. They were not wonderful jobs. They were not creative jobs. They were a waste of our good time when we could have been doing other, much more educative and much more socially productive work. But what we were doing was we were working for the market, and that established that it was good work. And we absolutely refute that jobs that do not mean anything to us and do not help the society generally, we refute that that is the way that we should be spending our lives. We don't want to do that work, not anymore. Not on the plantation, not in the factory, not in the call center, not on zero-hour contract, none of it. We've had it. We've had enough of it. So some women went out to work, and the single mothers fought and continue to fight to have their own income. And also to establish that this was their right and that what they were doing was useful and important. But we were faced by that time with feminism, which had increasingly identified sexism as that which keeps women from high positions. Now, that's not what we meant by sexism. We meant all of the degrading relationships and demeaning and exploitative relationships in the society which women more than men, even more than men, had to face. And that was what we wanted to change. But when you want to make a change at the grassroots, one of the things that you have to consider is who is on your side that has more power than you. And the role of feminism has not always been a good one. Now, I know that many, if not most of the women here, consider themselves feminists. That's fine. I don't mean you. Because you wouldn't be here if you were the 4 minutes, which is ridiculous. if you were not interested in another definition of sexism. I have to be brief, but I'll have to do more than 4 minutes. When the austerity hit, the ways in which women were out to work, and they said, all out. The austerity hit us, and Fawcett Society has done a very good piece of work showing that 79% of the cuts in jobs and services have been cuts that hurt women, and particularly women as carers. And everything by that time, in order for them to impose austerity, they had to undermine motherhood. They had to destroy the credibility of the women who were doing the caring work in the society. They had to make an industry of caring which would not care. You know, a nurse has told us that he, a male nurse, a lovely man, said that his supervisor said, look, you don't have to talk to them. Just bandage the leg and leave. And so we have had to have whistleblowers to tell us that brutality in all of these, quote, services that we once respected and that we once had confidence in, maybe more than we should have, you know, that what was really going on there was brutality and not caring. Now, I want to just say a couple of other things. Instead of the perspective of a living wage for mothers and other carers, which is our petition, I'm sure you'll see many of them here today, some people are saying a basic income for everyone. And I'm very sympathetic to that view because it denies that you must be a slave in order to eat. And that's a very good thing to establish. You don't have to be a slave in order to eat. If you're hungry, then you should eat. Not at food banks either, as thousands and thousands of children, especially children, are doing right now. But the basic income has a basic flaw, and that is it does not say that we are working, and it does not prioritize the carer's work. And that is a basic flaw because the whole perspective of caring has to be based precisely on the caring that is being done. I want to say just a couple of other things that I must squeeze in. We didn't want to be defined by our biology. And absolutely right. Why, if you have the ability to make a child, you should not have pay equity, I don't know. It doesn't make sense. They open the door for you and you can go through, but you're poorer than he is. And you live at a lower standard of living between women and men in partnerships. This has changed somewhat, but the one that I remember best is the one where a husband and wife live at two entirely different standards of living. He has money and she has not, or he has some money and she has less. But on the one hand, we don't want it to be the occasion for exploitation and just discarding. But we want it to be what it actually is, which is a basic contribution to the human race and to society generally. And we want the power that that work and that contribution implies. We must have it. On top of that, we want every right that any man has. You know, and I think working with Payday, who is one of the sponsors of this conference, have the ability to make a child, you should not have pay equity, I don't know. It doesn't make sense. They open the door for you and you can go through, but you're poorer than he is. And you live at a lower standard of living between women and men in partnerships. This has changed somewhat, but the one that I remember best is the one where a husband and wife live at two entirely different standards of living. He has money and she has not, or he has some money and she has less. But on the one hand, we don't want it to be the occasion for exploitation and just discarding. But we want it to be what it actually is, which is a basic contribution to the human race and to society generally. And we want the power that that work and that contribution implies. We must have it. On top of that, we want every right that any man has. You know, and I think working with Payday, who is one of the sponsors of this conference, that men understand that very well, even before we explain it, because increasingly men have understood, especially men in this country who work the longest hours in Europe, and then somebody says, you have to share the housework, I would refuse myself. You know, that biology is not merely physical. Biology is social. Biology is part of who we are as human beings and how we relate as human beings. Now, that's a small part of the reason that we have a living wage petition, which is doing all kinds of work, including pointing to the fact that most of the people in the world who are doing most of the work of the world are people of color. That sometimes escapes, the obvious, the eyes of authorities. And that all of the work, or a lot, not all, a lot of the work of justice against racism, against sexism, against homophobia, against disability racism, against ageism, against all of the discriminations is part of the work that women have been doing as an extension of the caring work that we have done. We don't want to be the only carers. But we have a choice. Either we give up caring and become brutes, or we stay with caring and become exploited. No. We want something else. We want a society that supports carers, and we want a society that is a caring society, and we cannot settle for less. Thank you. Yeah.
We are going to take a short station break. When we return, we will continue listening to presenters in the panel entitled Reproducing the Human Race, Valuing Mothers and All Caregivers. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth. You can check us out on SoundCloud. Go to www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, like and friend us on Facebook, and you could listen to our show there as well. We'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the UK. And we are listening to Reproducing the Human Race, Valuing Mothers and All Caregivers. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Thank you, Selma James. Alison Wolfe.
Right. Well, I'm not sure how I follow that. But I would like to start by saying how absolutely delighted I am that Selma and all of you have asked me here and are interested in my work, because what I'm going to try to do today is to be perhaps a little bit academic. And if you are interested in what I'm going to say, do read the article that sort of got me involved in this in the first place, the book, which is about the world that we live in, and which tries to say a little bit, which is what I want to say, about where we are now and about my belief that if we want to understand how to actually make even a small amount of change, and I am a bit gradualist, Selma, it's a good idea to start by understanding where the world is. And so I'm going to take 1 minute, actually, to talk about the good news before we get on to the bad news, which obviously is going to figure centrally. And I think the good news about the world today is that it is a very different place. So, Selma, I don't think you should feel that everything failed. The world today is one in which, when you actually look at the time people spend, in which certainly in developed countries, things are shared more equally between men and women, and men do far more housework than they did 50 years ago or even 30 years ago. And all across the world, fathers are supportive of daughters' education, and this is all actually very different. And then the question becomes, well, given that so much that seemed extraordinary 50 years ago or 100 years ago has happened, why is there still so much that still bothers us? You know, I often feel that for my generation and for people who are younger than me, the thing which has changed for women is that you no longer need to be truly extraordinary to do anything. And that is a huge triumph. You know, we read about these amazing women, including you, actually. and you sort of tend to think, well, I couldn't have done that. And I'm sure I couldn't, but I didn't need to. And that was thanks to previous generations. But I think it also is about the fact that here we are, and here is the world as it is today. And my heart, I have a husband who does housework of a sort that my father and father-in-law would never have conceived of. And this is a real change. But. We're also in a world in which there is growing inequality, and in which inequality is growing faster among women than it is among men. Now, partly that's just a result of some women succeeding. But it also underlines something which I think is really important, and it's the theme of my book and why I spend my time going around saying that, honestly and truthfully, if you're a female banker, you're a banker. Because what has actually happened, and we should have expected this, is that just as we don't want to be defined entirely by our gender, so it's also true that, I'm sorry, but being female doesn't automatically make you virtuous. It just doesn't. Might help. But no, really it doesn't. And I don't know, let me ask you a question. How many of you here have read Animal Farm? How many of you have read it recently? Okay, go back and reread it. It still really works. And I want to start with the final sentence, and this is perhaps overdone. I mean, we're not talking about anything quite as bad as Stalin's Russia. The last sentence goes, "The creatures outside looked from pig to man and from man to pig and from pig to man again, but already it was impossible to say which was which." And the point I want to make is that human beings are a mixture. They have a good side and they have a bad side. They have altruism and generosity. They also have selfishness and self-interest. And what has happened in our world is that for many women, it has offered opportunities that never existed before. There are many women who deservedly have got good jobs, professional careers, are making large sums of money. But what has also happened, and this is what makes me, I have to say, very angry, is that people who are privileged, including women who are privileged, have followed an age-old pattern of feeling that they deserve their privilege. Yeah, yeah. This is a really easy trap to fall into. We all like to feel good about ourselves. We all like to feel that we are where we are because of something that is about us. Not about luck, not about chance, not about the fact that actually we were born into the right family or went to the right school. And you can see this happening. And so to me, the most depressing aspect of modern self-labeled feminism is the extent to which it has become about promoting the interests of the women who are already the most privileged as the most important aspect of modern feminism. And it really matters. It really matters because these are the opinion formers. They shouldn't be, but they are. When people write columns in the broadsheets, when people from large companies, lobby politicians, as they're in the easiest position to do, this has an impact. And it's all very well to say, well, politicians should realize this is narrow self-interest. I mean, I actually have a certain sympathy with politicians. Things rain down on them all the time. Every time they turn around, somebody is lobbying them for something. And so if the opinion makers, the people who say they speak for women, spend most of their time arguing for positions which are actually about helping the most privileged, then that is what politicians are going to hear. And so when a British Prime Minister, and I suspect the same is true in many other countries, thinks that the most important thing he can do to make women happy is to start setting targets for women on the top companies' boards, it's easy to blame him, but I think it's also a little unfair, because if he's hammered around all the time by influential female columnists saying that they speak for women, he's likely to conclude that, okay, what does he know? He's not a woman. Fine. So I do have a little sympathy there. Not a lot of sympathy. It's also easy politics. It's gesture politics. He must know it's gesture politics. But I also think that it's a really bad aspect of what has happened to our countries. And it isn't, you know, the countries that I know, it's by no means only this one. The other thing that I want to say a bit about, and this picks up very much on the theme of this conference and the importance of care, is again something that Selma said. I mean, I've talked about the fact that we have this growing gulf between the top 15 to 20% of women. It's not just the top 1%. It is, I'm afraid, people like me generally. It's that for people who have really good jobs and are female, life is better in many ways than it has ever been. But the gulf between the top 15% of men and women and the other 85% has been growing everywhere in recent years in the developed world. Again, not just the US, not just the UK. It is something which I think we need to take really seriously. So that's the first thing. But the other thing that I want to say is that we have actually, and here I agree with you, become obsessed with paid work. Paid work outside the home. And again, as somebody who's a policy wonk, and I'm going to, at the end, come back to policy wonkdom and its virtues alongside revolution, we have become obsessed with this. There is, at the moment, for example, in this country, a big increase going through in free childcare. And on the one hand, that sounds great, and it sounds like something which we should all support. But what is slightly horrifying about it is it is all seen in terms of getting women out of the house into paid employment. That's how it's justified. That's how it's discussed. You know, when the Treasury is doing its sums, it's all in terms of how many additional women with children under five will go into the workforce. And I think that this is a sign of a society that has actually got itself back to front in some key and core ways. So I will try to accelerate a little, but I want to then say a bit more about what this has come to mean in practice, this obsession with the value, the status, the prestige of paid employment outside the home. The first thing, of course, which has happened is that what we have as a result of a large number of successful professional women is a large number of women who, without liking to admit it to themselves, depend on the cheap labour of other women.
Yes.
And that is so, and you know, you get that just dramatically. And, you know, again, I've asked you if you've read Animal Farm. Who here has read Lean In? Okay, you probably decided you didn't want to read Lean In. Lean In has been a phenomenon. Lean In is basically how you too can run Google. And the answer is you can run Google if you have a rich husband and three nannies. and another more recent, and it's been a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, it absolutely has been. It's kind of, you know, it's sold in its millions. But the problem is that when you hear professional women arguing for the importance of more flexible childcare, more special arrangements for make it easier for them to work different hours, always remember that one woman's flexibility is only too likely to be another low-paid woman's shift work.
We are here.
These are jobs which are almost all done by women, and in fact they are increasingly done by women, because actually we seem to be more and more unwilling to have them done by men, but that's a whole other discussion. So I think this is a deeply flawed way of looking at things, and I also do think it's a very hard thing to shift. But before coming back to trying to wrap this up and whether there's anything we can do about it except deplore it, scream about it a lot more, please not let the people who are campaigning for the interests of the already privileged always to hold the floor. But I think it's also really important to realize that in many ways, people in modern society, the policymakers, the rich, the people at the top, and also, I have to say, in many ways, myself, because you don't always stand back from your own life. You get on with it. And this is why I do want to sort of, you know, wave a flag for academic statistics and actually trying to take a broad view and look at the numbers. But the reality is that however much societies provide organized childcare, care homes, people going in to help, our societies only function because of family help and neighborly help, above all family help. We could not survive as a society if we did not have families doing huge amounts for each other. It simply could not be done. It doesn't factor in the equations. People don't think about it enough. They often don't even realize that their life, in which they're juggling care, their own family, looking after people, trying to do a job, having a career if you're fortunate, that actually that is being replicated everywhere, and that adds up to a huge amount of what keeps our modern societies on the road. It's that, it's not, you know, the organized care, the subsidized care, the stuff that's threatened by austerity, all of that is important, but it's never been enough and it never will be enough, because states cannot pay for everything, and they should not pay for everything, because actually One needs to have a space in which one can care for the people that one loves. And maybe we should all love everybody equally, but actually we don't all love everybody equally. We love our families and our closest friends, above all our families first. And that's the only way that human societies can operate. And we ought to be building on it, not fighting it. Where does this lead me? Apart from the fact that having sort of sat down and looked at the statistics, I also became very aware of how in many ways our societies had sort of gone wrong, that so often one victory had led to a different problem, that we have this growing inequality, we have this growing dependence by the professional middle classes, and I would say it's both men and women, they are partners. It's not just about blaming the women, it's about saying these lifestyles depend on other people's low-paid work. But it's also about an obsession with getting everybody out of the household and into paid employment that actually really hits up against the realities of effective, loving care. So what can one actually do? I think there are two things that we can do, and they're actually, I'm afraid, they are quite small. I mean, it's not about blowing up Westminster, unfortunately. Well, no, not unfortunately. That's not true. I don't want to blow up anybody. I'm quite peaceable, really. I think the first thing is that I want to agree with Selma. In any family, it is important that people have resources that they can control. Resources which give them a say and give them power, that people are not utterly dependent on somebody else. That's very bad for both sides of the relationship. But I also think that there are two things that we can do, and this is why I want to make a plea for gradualism. I think, first of all, we have to shift the mindset. We have to make people outside this room aware of the things that everybody here says, yes, yes, and you already knew it. But this is my confession. Until I started working on this, which was a pure accident, I mostly work on the higher education and employment policy and all sorts of other things. Till I started working on it, I hadn't really taken on board either this widening gulf, this dividing up. I hadn't taken up how obsessed with getting everybody out policies all over the world were. I hadn't understood a whole load of things, and I hadn't actually started to get furious with so many of my contemporaries. So the first thing is you need to go out and you need to say it, and we need to make sure that it isn't only the people who are calling for quotas for women in Westminster, quotas for women on boards, quotas for privileged women in privileged positions. Somebody needs to call them out on it. More people. I mean, I'm not, you know, I do a bit, but that's just me. Other people need to do much more. I'm doing faster. So that's the first thing. The second thing I think we need to try to do, and this is where I come to the policy wonkdom and the trying to think about small policy changes as well as the broad brush changing how society looks, is that actually sometimes small shifts can make a difference. But if you're going to convince politicians and policymakers, it's not just about the broad sweep, the priorities. It's also about presenting them with concrete proposals that they might actually be able to put into place if they are ever in power. And this is one of the choices that one makes in life about whether to, if you like, compromise with power a bit but try to have some concrete influence, or whether one decides that actually one's path in life is to be the equally necessary person talking about the broad brush, changing the view. And I actually think that the most important thing that we could do in this country, and I'm talking now about this country because it's the one where I know policy best, is to actually rail against a whole load of policies that basically say, we don't trust people to use money. So if we give money out for childcare, or we give out money for care for the elderly, or we give out money for anything, we are going to hem it around with huge numbers of regulations. We're going to say, you've got to be accountable, you've got to keep a record, because otherwise, heaven forbid, somebody might actually use the money to pay their granny. Well, I'm sorry, paying one's granny to look after somebody is probably the best and most useful thing one could do. Everybody to go out of here today and start a campaign to allow anybody who is receiving benefits from the state to use it to pay their granny. Thank you.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, our engineer, and Sherelle Withers, our longtime intern. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230, or go online to PacificaRadioArchives.org. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
KBOO, good morning. It's 8:58. This is KBOO Portland, and Press Watch is next.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Limpress. Live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. Limpress, four unruly, lewd queens playing hardcore call for all dykes, rough girls, sissy boys, trans folks, leather teos, fierce queens, punks, the non-defined, and the questioning, to come get loose at their only Northwest show. Also playing are Xylitol from Olympia and Portland's Labinden Toten and Petite. Again, that's Limpress, live Friday, March 23rd at 8 p.m. at the Bossa Nova Ballroom, 722 East Burnside Street in Portland. This is an all-ages show. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Girl.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Americana singer-songwriter Libby Roderick, Saturday, March 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Levin Community Center in Portland. Libby Roderick is an internationally known environmental and peace activist and musician. This concert contributes toward building community through music. Again, that's Americana singer-songwriter Libby Roderick, Saturday, March 24th from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Levin Community Center, 5431 Northeast 20th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Light shining out from our eyes, and the dreams resting deep in our soul.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda on your left opinion program. This is Press Watch, a left opinion program on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an example.